This podcast is brought to you by the Village of Bedford Park, your home for business. Over 450 businesses strong and growing with a safe, reliable Lake Michigan water supply. Visit VOBPbiz.com and bring your business home to the Village of Bedford Park.
This is Chicago's all-news station, News Radio 780 and 105.9 FM. Now, the WBBM Noon Business Hour.
WBBM News Time 12:03. It's great to have you with us for the Tuesday edition of the Noon Business Hour. I'm Cisco Cotto in Chicagoland. We're seeing more and more of the sun, and that will continue not only throughout the day, but also throughout the week. Travel Tuesday. What do you do if you're planning a trip to an area and then there's a natural disaster? Key reports on manufacturing, the housing market, those are out today as well. We'll see what that says about the overall economy and the Fed in our next segment. Right now, the thrill ride of the oil markets. It just keeps going way down today, about 4.5%. Phil Flynn is joining us, senior market analyst at the Price Group, also a Fox Business News contributor. Phil, I guess you certainly can't say this has been a boring week for oil.
Oh, my gosh. We haven't seen anything like it. I mean, we had a historic move to the upside, a big sell-off today, and now it looks like the market's trying to mount another comeback, and price is back above $60 a barrel, really because we're getting a lot of conflicting stories about how bad the damage was to that Saudi oil field and conflicting stories as to how quickly it can come back online.
Is that really, I guess, one of the challenges of dealing with a commodity as opposed to a stock, where just moment to moment you get a different piece of news, world events can radically change things?
It really is. And I'll tell you, you know, I think for the last couple of years, we've been kind of complacent. You know, we look at news stories, things happening overseas, risk to supply, and the market never really got rattled. And it didn't get rattled because the U.S. is the biggest oil producer in the world, and they thought, you know what, whatever happens in the Middle East isn't going to affect us, so, you know, we have all this supply. That may change after what happened over the weekend. I mean, we've seen these dramatic price increases. We're going to see increases at the pump, and we're not sure that this isn't going to happen again. I mean, you know, the Saudis were caught by surprise. This attack seemed to go off without a hitch, and we're not convinced that the Saudis can stop another attack that would be similar in nature.
Now, talk about that, though. Talk about just the change with you have U.S. oil production so much higher than really at any point in history, and how that does impact the way things happen when there's a disaster like this or some sort of, whether it's man-made or whether it's something that's natural.
It is. I mean, back in the old days, if this would have happened, you know, the price of oil would have gone up, you know, probably more than it did this time. And we would have seen gas prices at the pump go up $1 a gallon or $2 a gallon. And there'd be real panic that if the disruption lasted for a long period of time, the world could run out of oil or our country could have a major economic shock. That doesn't happen anymore because we have this buffer of supplies. The U.S. is the biggest producer, and even though we might feel some pain, you know, the expectation is that the U.S. producers can rise to the occasion and buffer that somewhat. But you don't want to get too complacent on the other hand. Yes, we are a big producer, but if we continue to see disruptions in the global supplies, it is going to hurt. And I think that what we saw in the market with that big surge up in one day was kind of a wake-up call.
Really interesting. Thank you so much, Phil Flynn, a senior market analyst at Price Group. Also a Fox Business News contributor. As Phil mentioned, oil is back above the $60 mark. It had dipped more than 5%. Now it's down a little more than 4% on the day. The Federal Reserve has opened its latest two-day meeting on interest rates. While reports on manufacturing and home building are out today, we're joined by Josh Shapiro, chief U.S. economist at the New York-based economic and marketing consulting firm MFR, Inc. Josh, good to have you back on the show. So let's talk about some of these data points and information that we're getting in here. Before we get into it, though, does this make any sort of a difference in what the Fed does over the next couple of days, or do they already know what they want to do?
No, I think they probably already know what they want to do. And even if they didn't know what they wanted to do, today's data, I don't think would have affected the decision. Neither one of these reports today, I think, had much in the way of new information, and certainly not anything to change anybody's mind about what's going on.
Yeah, not remarkable, not making anyone think that we're headed toward a recession, which, of course, has been such a fear for a while.
Well, these indicators are pretty much coincident indicators. They're not telling you much about the future. things that are telling you about the future, sort of the slope of the yield curve, other leading indicators like that are certainly flashing yellow or red in terms of what's down the road. The difficulty is the time frame involved. There can be very long lead times for indicators like this. As of now, the economy is doing okay, particularly given the huge headwinds that are out there, but that doesn't necessarily mean it's going to stay that way.
If it, say, does continue to rebound, and maybe we don't get the recession that most people do believe is on the horizon, does that maybe change the way some of the data, whether it's the yield curve or other things, are interpreted going forward? I mean, none of this is foolproof, but a lot of it's pretty reliable.
Well, I think that in terms of the inversion of the yield curve and things like, you know, other things that people look at, RV shipments, there's, you know, some of the minutiae in consumer confidence and sentiment surveys, the differences between current conditions and expected conditions, things that have been in the past fairly reliable recession indicators, they don't necessarily tell you a time frame. So I think you could continue to get reasonably decent economic data about the current situation, and it doesn't mean you're not going to have a slump sometime down the road. I think the Fed is very cognizant of that. They're going to try to do their best, I think, to try to head that off. And I think, you know, the easing move we're like very likely to see tomorrow is going to be, you know, one of the series. I don't see this as a little correction, you know, that was talked about several months ago, and we haven't heard much about that since.
If we do get sort of a series of smaller interest rate cuts from the Fed, does that validate raising rates like they did? Because now they have this tool in their belt.
Well, you know, that's always been something that people drag out. Well, if they raise rates by more, then they have more powder, you know, for when they need to cut rates, which, you know, it's appealing in a certain way, but it also kind of doesn't make sense if you think about it. You know, if you're thinking about cutting rates in the future, why are you raising them now? I think what it does is it points out that they don't know any more than anybody else about the future. And that, you know, and I think that when people are looking for guidance from the Fed right now, the Fed is better off providing as little as possible. I mean, you can provide guidance when the future is more certain and you kind of know what you're going to do. Like, we're going to keep interest rates unchanged for a long time because that sort of thing. But when things are moving around and the evidence is mixed, why are you trying to provide guidance when it's clear you really don't know what you're going to be doing? And I think that's the conundrum that they're in right now.
Yeah, we've had a more transparent, for good or bad, we've had a more transparent Fed for a while now. Is that, I'm kind of tracking with what you're saying here, maybe a reason for them to, I don't want to say keep their mouths shut, but just, you know, don't give us as much because you probably don't really know.
Well, exactly. It's the more they say now, the more they tend to confuse people. Because number one, you get a mixed message. There's differences of opinion on the FOMC. That's pretty clear. And the evidence is not clear about what we're facing in terms of the economy. So for them to sit there and give any sort of clear guidance is just misleading, or can be misleading. And I think that they need to be very careful about how they word things and how they guide markets here.
Well, we'll be watching what they say. Thanks so much for the insight, Josh Shapiro, chief U.S. economist at the New York-based economic and market consulting firm, MFR, Inc.
Investing 60 minutes each weekday toward planning for the future. The WBBM Noon Business Hour continues.
NBC Universal's new streaming service named Peacock will debut in April. Let's talk about it with Tom Lason, president of New Media Solutions and NewMediaSolutions.tv based in Seattle. Called Peacock, of course, that makes sense, Tom. Kind of cute. I get the connection there. Is NBC telling us any more about exactly what the streaming service is going to be like?
Well, I would say the name certainly implies some confidence, and quite frankly, they should have it. They're a content creator, a well-established one for a long time, many decades. They're bringing 15,000 hours of content to the table here. You know, we've said it for a long time, but this is cycling back up into being the truth again and continuing to be the truth, and that is that content is king. So, you know, they've got The Office coming in 2021. We've discussed that before, that Netflix was going to lose that to this venture. Parks and Rec and everything else NBC has produced. So that content library and being able to leverage that is going to be key to having a successful service.
Now, is there a chance, obviously NBC probably doesn't think so, but is there a chance that these shows have been watched so much already on Netflix that they just won't be quite the draw that NBC's expecting them to be?
You would think so, but, you know, a new generation keeps discovering these shows. I was literally talking to my son and my daughter-in-law a couple of nights ago. They are on their fourth pass through The Office. I couldn't believe it. But people discover these shows that you can watch one episode and walk away. They're snackable, and they are proven winners, and there's such a huge library of them. You know, Warner's going to be launching this spring as well in the $15 to $18 price point. They're going to have Big Bang Theory. You know, Disney is coming on board. Apple's coming on board. So there's lots of competition out there that's probably going to drive production costs up, which I think is going to be a negative for a player like Netflix. But I think there's a large appetite for this well-established good content. How many times can people watch it? I guess I don't know.
Yeah, over and over maybe. Do I understand right that NBC, there may be ads sort of similar to Hulu, unlike Netflix?
Yeah, it's going to be both an ad and a subscription service. And boy, you know, that's the dream model. Comcast and the cable companies have had this for years. You know, they're charging me, the subscriber, to watch the commercials they're selling. Boy, you know, it's nice work if you can get it. I'm surprised that model's lingered and that the consumers haven't balked at that a little bit, but that's what they're going to be doing.
Now, you mentioned that, obviously, Netflix is the one that everyone is wondering about. How are they going to be able to last? They're almost definitely going to just have to continue generating new content if they're going to compete, because most of the other content creators are going to be streaming it themselves.
Well, that's the thing. You know, they were a hit when they were first and the only service, but they're basically slowly being disassembled. And on top of that, you know, they had a string of hits early on, and it really seemed easy, Cisco. It seemed like, gosh, this was easy, making hit television shows. They were novel. They were new. People were rebelling. People were cutting the cords. And now they're going to be into the same mix that the networks have been in for decades. Trying to come up with those hit shows is an expensive and very hit-and-miss proposition.
Yeah, we'll see how Netflix does and see how many of these services people are willing to pay for. Thank you, Tom Lason, president of New Media Solutions and newmediasolutions.tv.
The WBBM Noon Business Hour continues.
Good afternoon. I'm Cisco Cotto. These are the top stories on News Radio WBBM. The recent hurricane in the Bahamas and fires in Indonesia are reminders of how Mother Nature can rapidly alter your vacation plans. We'll explore what you can do in Travel Tuesday. The weekend attack on oil facilities in the Middle East has impacted financial markets in the U.S. Could it be an overreaction? Nurses at the University of Chicago Medical Center could stage a one-day walkout later this week. On Wall Street, the Dow is down 30 points, NASDAQ up 2, and the S&P down 1. Oil down 4.5% today, still in the $60 range. We're getting sunshine in Chicagoland, high of 79 degrees. Right now, 72 O'Hare, 73 Midway, and 72 degrees along Chicago's lakefront. The Noon Business Hour is presented by the Village of Bedford Park. Markets pretty much near the flat line today. Let's see what's going on. Steve Esposito is joining us, Executive Director at Morgan Stanley Wealth Management in Lake Forest. Steve, good to have you on the show. So tell us, what are you seeing on Wall Street today?
Just a mixed bag today, and thank you for having me on. The Dow's down, the NASDAQ's up a little bit, but it's kind of a mixed with a negative slant in the market right now.
Are we seeing Wall Street maybe hanging on, waiting to see what happens with the Saudi Arabia situation? Maybe is it the Fed that's also meeting? I mean, kind of in a wait-and-see mood?
I think the answer is yes to all of those. There's so many cross-currents in the market right now that investors aren't sure which way to turn. When you look at what's happened with Saudi Arabia, the price of energy jumping 7, now down almost 3 today. What's it going to do to the economy? What's the Fed going to do? What is Europe going to do? Are they going to enter some fiscal stimulus, which would be great? So there's just so much uncertainty and tack on the computers, and you just got a volatile market.
You know, is this a time then? I mean, I guess we might say that it's always this time, but is it time to just get back to the basics, look at the fundamentals of different stocks, different sectors, different companies, and actually make your investing decisions based on that sort of data instead of some of these cross currents?
Oh, absolutely. I mean, the long-term investor has to not pay attention to what's going on in the volatility of the market. You've got to look at good companies, look where you can get some nice dividends in this market, especially with interest rates being low all over the world. Look at some price-to-earnings multiples, price-to-book. Look at some cheap stocks. There's a lot of them out there. But As you said, there's this constant talk about a swap from growth to value, and you've seen a lot of that in the last 2 weeks. And we'll see if this market continues to broaden out. If it does, I think that's really healthy for the market. It's just, it can't be a mile high and an inch wide. It needs to be broadening out where more companies are participating.
Yeah, the cheap money, I don't think we talk about that enough. The fact that you can really deploy money to make money in a market like this just because you can get access to it so easily.
Oh, absolutely. You look at how low interest rates are and what the U.S. government's paying to borrow money. It's very cheap right now. So rates are, the opportunity to get low interest loans is never been better. So you've got to look at it that way. It's just this fact that you have so much, $17 trillion in negative rates overseas. It's kind of mixing up the markets a little bit. You have a lot of foreign investors buying our bonds, driving our yields down. A former yield curve that was inverted is now no longer inverted. The talk of recession, which I don't think is even shouldn't be discussed right now. It's nowhere near on the horizon, but that's still spooking the market. So it's a whole bunch of factors that are confusing investors and creating uncertainty, which is creating this volatility.
I wonder if that fear of a recession, a lot of people may be holding back because they think it might happen. Does that present opportunities for investors to maybe take advantage of some things?
Oh, absolutely. I mean, if you talk recession enough, you can talk yourself into one. For a year now, we've been hearing the drumbeat of recession, recession, recession. If you look at the last three quarters of GDP growth, it's been substantially better than anything that most people had thought. And you're also, it's not even close to a recession. And looking forward, NABE, National Association of Business Economists, just recently said only a third of them interviewed think that we'll see a recession in the year 2021. That means two-thirds don't think there's going to be any recession even then. So the fear of it is hampering down and keeping some companies low, especially cyclicals. And that's where all the values are. If you look across the board at some really low multiple stocks and some pretty good dividends, investors can find some bargains.
Yeah, sector-wise, any areas that you're looking at these days?
Well, if we do get a deal with China and we do get some more normalization, and, you know, here's another if we see some fiscal stimulus out of Europe, that could be a game changer. And investors can start flocking more towards the growth and the cyclical companies. And if you look at anything from healthcare to financials to industrials, all of that, including energy, you could see some real movement in there to the upside, we hope. And again, while you're waiting, dividends out there are pretty good.
And do we have to wait to see if, I mean, you talk about dividends. Do we have to wait and see whether the earnings continue? There's been some forward guidance that maybe they're going to be soft for a while. Do we actually have to wait and see what the numbers are before making some of these decisions?
Yes and no. I think this obsession with beating analyst expectations, whether you're a penny above or a penny below, without looking at the long-term big picture or the value of the company, I think is not servicing the markets any well or investors. This obsession with companies who don't make any money but their sales are up and those stocks keep going up, and companies who are a little bit more boring but are returning some pretty good profits and some nice dividends are being ignored because of the obsession with growth. I think that concerns me. And if we do see some, movement more from growth to value and a more even-keeled market, I think that'll be good. So I just think people shouldn't focus on whether the earnings are a penny or below or a penny above or if sales are supposed to be another tenth of a percent. Look at the big picture.
I'm so glad to hear you say that, because for years I've just not understood this. You get these expectations and they are just a hair off and the stock craters. And you say, wait a minute, this just doesn't make any sense here.
Right. It's this obsession with trading. It's more of a trading mentality, which I think is not helping the integrity of the financial system, the algorithm of the trading. Whether you like it or you love it, does affect it. But believe me, it's not investors calling me and saying, get out of that company because the earnings were a dollar. They're supposed to be a dollar one. That's not what's happening. So, but I get at the same time, I'm seeing bargains out there. I've even read recently that the spread between value and growth is the widest in history, even more than the dot-com bubble. At some point, I have to agree that that's going to narrow. That's going to equalize. And there's some opportunities on the value side and some potential disasters on the growth side. So I'd be very careful.
Certainly opportunities to make money. Thank you. Steve Esposito, Executive Director of Morgan Stanley Wealth Management in Lake Forest. Up next, Travel Tuesday, earthquakes in Italy, a hurricane in the Bahamas. What do you do when a natural disaster affects your trip?
Because money matters. This is the WBBM Noon Business Hour.
It is Travel Tuesday on the Noon Business Hour, sponsored by Hamilton County Tourism. This afternoon, we're getting help in dealing with the intrusion of a major weather event or other natural disaster on your trip. Let's get some help from Joe Brancatelli, editor and publisher of JoeSentMe.com, based in New York. Joe, paint the scenario here for us. What are we talking about? Someone's thinking about a trip and then trouble happens?
Well, you know, people plan the trip of their lifetime, perhaps, you know, to the Caribbean, and a hurricane comes, or maybe they're going to Singapore for their first trip to Asia, and suddenly you can't literally see Singapore because of the Indonesia fires, or earthquakes, which can happen anytime. Natural disasters are the one thing you literally cannot plan for. You could say, well, it's hurricane season, what did you expect? A snowstorm in that locks down Chicago one day, and this is going to be your first visit to Chicago. You know, these are things you just can't plan for, which make them the most dangerous travel issue.
And that's not something that an airline or, you know, they're necessarily going to take care of, right? I mean, if the flight lands, then you got to pay for it, even if there's nothing for you to see when you get there.
Yes, that is true, Cisco. However, think about it this way. An airliner, you know, standard 200-seat airplane, costs hundreds of millions of dollars. Airlines don't want to fly them into places that are too dangerous either. So if you're thinking about perhaps canceling a trip that you planned because of a natural disaster or a weather event, you could take some comfort from the fact that the airline is willing to put this very expensive piece of technology on the ground. You know, before a snowstorm, for example, if someone says, okay, Chicago is going to be buried next week, let's hope it's not next week, United and American will fly all their planes out of Chicago because they don't want them stuck on the ground in a snowstorm. So same thing you can think about as a traveler. If the airline's flying there, that's good. That's relatively good news. If they're not flying there, you're already off the hook for the airfare because they have to refund if they don't fly.
So then how does travel insurance play into this? Because obviously if a flight's canceled, then you're out, at least initially, right? What do you do with travel insurance?
Well, travel insurance, now the trick with travel insurance, first of all, you would buy that to cover the parts of your travel that you're at risk for, okay? So if you haven't paid for your hotel room yet, rather than a prepaid deal, then you don't have to worry about that. If for some bizarre reason the airline didn't want you to pay in advance for your airfare, then you're not covered. So first of all, think about only insuring that you're at risk for it. The other thing to be worried about for travel insurance is that many of them exempt what they call acts of God, and earthquakes and hurricanes and fires are, regardless of your religious beliefs, considered acts of God in insurance. So you need to buy the right policy. But travel insurance can go a very long way into keeping you in sound mind when you're thinking about a very long, very expensive trip and something might pop up. So that is worth considering.
So how do you make the decision whether to try to make the trip work, maybe with some changes, or just to say forget it and scrap the trip altogether?
Well, I think everyone's level of pain, Cisco, is different. And I hate to talk about travel and pain in the same sentence because you're always hoping for the trip of your lifetime, even if it's just a simple jaunt, say, to Florida for a weekend or to visit some friends in Des Moines kind of thing. So it comes to the point of what are you willing to risk? Let's take the perfect example right now in the Bahamas. If you're planning a Bahamas trip, if you're going to Nassau, you're just fine. Nassau was barely touched. It barely rained in that part of the Bahamas. But if you had planned to go to Marsh Harbor in the Abacos or Freeport, which was the Grand Bahama Islands, these islands have basically been wiped out, and there's no reason for you to go unless you want to be a volunteer, and I'm not minimizing that. So I think you need to look carefully at the information that's available to you and then make a judgment based on your comfort level. You know, if you can handle a little smoke, I guess it's still okay to go to Singapore. You know, if you're not too worried about hurricanes, plan your trip now for October, November, and into December, which is technically still hurricane season. So that part of it, in the end, it rests with you and your comfort level.
thanks so much for all of the details. Joe Brancatelli, editor and publisher, joesentme.com, based in New York. This time tomorrow, Personal Finance Wednesday. Still to come, making sure investors don't overreact to problems in the oil market.
Cashing in with conversation. The WBBM Noon Business Hour continues.
Events like this past weekend's oil production facility attacks in Saudi Arabia can push some investors to make reactive moves. Let's talk about the appropriate response with Mark Hulbert, investment columnist for The Wall Street Journal, Barron's, and MarketWatch.com, based in Washington, D.C. Mark, let me guess here. The right move yesterday, right at the open, was to rush in and start buying oil stocks, right?
Well, who knows what the right reaction is. Usually if you react instantly after news hits the market, it's usually a bad time to do anything. So that's probably not a good idea. But in general, as you know, I take what's called a contrarian approach. So I typically do the opposite of what the market is doing. So I have some sympathy with what you're presuming in the question. The reason that I think that perhaps people were being far too knee-jerk in the reaction to what happened over the weekend is that over the last decade, the U.S. has become gradually, but is now either even in the sense of exports of petroleum products or equaling imports of petroleum products, to actually in some periods, some quarters, some months, depending on the data from the government, we are actually a net exporter of oil. So if you look at the net effect on the U.S. economy as a whole of higher price, it has to be more good than bad. And I didn't see anyone else pointing that out, which is why I was perhaps a little bit impolitically saying that it actually could be a good thing for the U.S. economy.
Yeah, so explain that. Why could it be a good thing for the U.S. economy?
Well, if we are producing more than we're using, that means that any time that we sell, we're selling more overseas than we're paying to import oil. The higher price means that we're going to bring in more money than we're spending. So the net effect on the U.S. economy will be that we're better off. And you know, that doesn't mean there won't be disruptions here or there in particular industries. Airlines, for example, will have to pay more, and that's not going to be good for their bottom line. But if you were to sum up all the pluses and minuses, the benefits and the costs economy-wide, when you're a net exporter, you're better off for the higher price. That's almost by definition.
And so as an investor, is it time to start looking at some of the oil companies that, I don't know, maybe would have been kind of depressed as oil hovered around $50?
Well, that's right. I think you know, the oil has been out of favor for many years, and so I think there could have been an argument even prior to this past weekend to look at some of the oil companies that had the strongest balance sheets. I mean, if they were able to survive for over the last decade, they're probably going to be able to survive almost any downturn, and some of them pay very handsome dividends. So you could have made a compelling case a week ago prior to the attacks over the weekend to consider some of those stocks. Now that some of those stocks have been caught in the downdraft of the reaction on yesterday, because of those attacks, I think you probably have an even more compelling case than you did before.
As the contrarian, are you just looking for overreactions like this as opportunities to make money?
I think that's that's a good summary. I mean, it looks almost like it's too easy, but what it does require is a willingness to go against the crowd, and that's easier said than done. I mean, yesterday morning, and now it's sort of as the dust settles, it looks back and says, oh, that wouldn't have been that hard to do. But believe me, when you react just the opposite way to how everyone else is doing, it can seem like you're doing an awfully stupid thing. But over time, it doesn't work out every time, but over time, I suspect you'll end up doing better and being glad that you had that courage.
Always good insight. Thank you. Mark Hulbert, investment columnist for The Wall Street Journal, Barron's, and MarketWatch.com.
T-Mobile has invested billions to light up America's largest 5G network from big cities to small towns, including right here in yours. And great coverage is just the beginning. Right now, families and small businesses can save up to 20% versus AT&T and Verizon when they switch. Visit your local T-Mobile store today.
Plan savings with 3 lines of T-Mobile Essentials versus comparable available plans. Plan features and taxes and fees may vary.